I happen to grow up in a family that had two family businesses. My my father's side of the family did general contracting work. We did everything from renovations to building homes from the ground up. My mother's side of the family had a small HVAC company that my grandfather started from nothing. And so, you know, family business, what that means is that when you're big enough to start carrying stuff, that you start working during the summer. And that's really kind of how I got started. Just got woke up one morning, first day of summer, and said, hey, get up and get in the truck. And from then it was just go to work.
Hey guys, we'll get into the podcast in just a second. However, I'm looking for more great guests for the Blue Collar Voices show, and I've updated this older podcast with this announcement from November 2019. I am planning a road trip across America and including parts of Canada. I'll tell you more about both of these at the end of this podcast. Chris, are you ready to get started again?
Let's do this again.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Blue Collar Voices show. Today's guest is Chris Crawford. Chris has a diverse range of skill sets ranging from HVAC, construction, aircraft maintenance, as well as business acumen. Currently, Chris is the owner of Spring Branch AC, located in Houston, Texas, and AC is definitely an essential part of life in Houston. Fun fact, we had to restart this recording because I did not start it properly. Chris, thank you for your patience, and welcome to the Blue Collar Voices show.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'm happy to see that the red record button is on.
Awesome. Yeah, it's one of my special skills, being able to push a button or not. So, Chris, go ahead and summarize for me. What is it you do today, the main gist of your day-in and day-out responsibilities?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm the first guy in the door every morning. I get up at about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and make sure that my day is up and happening, and that everything is going to be okay after the third cup of coffee. And then I make the hour drive from where I live to where the office is at, and open the doors up, get the lights on, make coffee here, because you're going to need more of that during the day. But really what I do is to coordinate between the technicians and the clients, and really make sure that that everybody's on board with what's going on. There's good communication between the technicians and the clients, between the business and the clients, when we're showing up, when we're going to be there, what we're going to do. I'm involved in every call with every technician. As soon as they're done with their initial diagnostics, they're calling me so that we can bounce heads and make sure that we're on track and that we're good with what our plan is moving forward, and that gets translated properly to the client. And so I'm literally involved in every call with every technician.
So just like an off the wall number, like how many calls a day do you deal with?
You know, especially during the summertime, we're probably going to be 15 to 25 calls per day.
Wow. Well, this is summertime. It means you're a busy man right now.
That means it's ridiculous. Yes. And in fact, we were watching the weather forecast for the rest of this week. And I mean, it is the first week of September, which is usually when we see a little bit of a decline, but, looks like by Friday it's going to be 102, 103, and so summer's not done yet. Looks like it's going to be a long summer.
Well, Houston, I know, is very humid, and it is just crazy freaking hot. Without AC, I see that Houston could actually be kind of dangerous to live, especially the way we construct buildings nowadays. We don't actually have the ventilation.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I can't imagine trying to live in a home these days with no air conditioning. You're right. From the construction viewpoint, we used to design the houses because we knew which direction the wind would blow, and put the windows on the proper side of the house, and even design the inside of the home so that the airflow would travel from the front to the back and get good airflow through the home. But all of that is gone in construction design these days.
I remember the house we lived at in Kansas, which was an old farmhouse. It had the 10-foot tall ceilings. It had the transom windows over the doors. It had,
yep.
In the summer, you open up everything and it was just a constant flow. And the heat, you wouldn't feel the heat because each room, the heat was up higher away from you. I love the house, but we don't design anything like that nowadays.
No, I can't even get the guys to design the home to put the AC unit in the right spot in the attic space so that we can get proper airflow to each room. I don't know why somebody is always designing the master bedroom to be 400 feet away from where the AC unit is at. It just drives me crazy.
Well, that's interesting. And I don't know if you're exaggerating about the 400 feet or not.
Yeah, 400 feet is probably an exaggeration, but it is almost always the room that is the furthest away from the air handler in the attic space, which is crazy because you would think the master bedroom would be where the master is sleeping. You would want him to be the happiest, but that's usually not the case. It's usually the hardest room to get the right airflow to.
Understand, I'm not an expert on volume and flow and that type of thing, but the distance, is that something that's quite difficult to regulate, even though you have the ability to restrict, you know, with, you know, the reduction in pipe sizes and all the conduit sizes, whatever you call it, to control the airflow? The longer the does that really mess with the whole calculations?
Well, it does in today's world because, first of all, builders these days tend to put a system in a new home that's about a half a ton smaller than it should be. And then, you know, they hire the cheapest guys that they can get their hands on as subcontractors to put in the system. And so the ductwork design isn't really the way it should be either. Nobody's really taken the time to design it. It's just a couple of guys in the attic that day thinking, oh, well, that's probably going to be an 8-inch for that, and that's probably going to be a 7 for that. And really, that's how it's done. And it shouldn't be. And what it should have done is there should have been somebody with an actual calculator figuring airflow design and how to get the airflow from the air handler to the proper rooms. But yes, distance creates a problem when they go, you know, 50 feet or more, which is not uncommon when it's usually going over to the master bedroom. Even if it's designed properly, getting that type of throw of air 50 feet down the way in a residential setting is pretty difficult.
Does your company, do you guys ever get involved in the calculation and proper construction of the whole conduit system?
We do, but usually after there's a problem. We don't do any new construction work whatsoever. But we get houses to where people have moved in, and it's 2 years, 3 years down the road, and they're like, look, Chris, you know, my master bedroom's always hotter during the summer and colder during the winter, and I don't understand why I can't get that room to heat and cool properly. And so that's usually when we get involved, and we'll make some pretty major modifications to the ductwork design, and you know, we use some new technology as well to help balance the temperature throughout the home and do those types of things. Yeah, we get involved in that a lot, but unfortunately, it's not at the beginning; it's after there's already an issue in place.
Okay, so if you do that in old construction, have you gone to any houses that were built, designed, never had AC in it at all? Didn't even have that as a concept, and have you retrofitted AC into those type of homes?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We do a lot of that. Actually, we've done several, you know, 100-year-old plus farmhouses to even some homes that were built, you know, back in the 60s with no AC. And yes, yeah, we've done a lot of that. And to be honest, it's a lot of fun to do. It's not something that we get to do a lot of, but when we do, we have a lot of fun with it.
That's very cool. I like the whole, I like retrofitting. I like, not that I'm in AC retrofitting, but I do like the whole, I love the whole, you know, the building and the creating and the making things happen and like solve these kinds of problems and look what you got now.
Yeah. And you know, what they don't want to do in an older house like that, they don't want to see the air conditioner. They don't want to They don't want to even hear the air conditioner. They just want it to be nice and cool in the home, but not make any major modifications to the house. And so we've had to come up with some pretty unique designs and utilize even ductless systems these days to make those things happen in those homes. And it's always fun to sit down and do the planning for that.
Okay, what is ductless and how does that work?
So ductless systems, there's no ductwork whatsoever. You'll also hear them referred to as a mini split system. And so each individual area in the home actually has its own small air handler. And with all of the piping and the control wiring hooked up directly to the outdoor unit. And so each individual room has its own specialized air handler specifically for that room. No ductwork carrying the airflow throughout the house.
And so if I'm following that through, does that mean like it's got it when you say its own hair handler, does that mean its own heat exchanger for that particular zone?
Yep.
Okay.
Absolutely. So a heat exchanger, it's really, really nice. It's probably the future of air conditioning moving forward. As soon as we can kind of get the pricing in line, right now it's a little bit more expensive than I would like to see it to go in and retrofit a whole new home with a ductless system. But I think in the next couple of years, as conventional HVAC systems continue to get more and more expensive, and we can lessen the amount of costs on a ductless system, I really believe that that's going to be the future of our industry.
And so just one more step there. If I'm understanding correctly, you've got the heat exchanger there, but the actual compressor is still one compressor outside, and it's the system is just mixing and matching the Freon compression in these different zones to do the heat exchanging.
Absolutely. So what you'll have is you'll have up to 8 little small air handlers that are hooked up to one compressor or condenser system outside. And then depending on which room you're in, like it is the best way to do zone control. That air handler won't operate unless there's actually a person in that room. And it knows the difference, like between whether it's the dog or the human walking in the door. And so depending on how many systems are running at the moment, the outdoor unit will vary the amount of refrigerant flow to the air handlers. So it is incredibly economical. The efficiency ratings are somewhere in the 30 number, which is drastically higher than what you can get out of any conventional system these days.
And so like if you have a room that isn't needing to do any cooling or heating,
it just turns off. Yeah. It'll shut that air handler down. That air handler won't run. It will have a minimum and maximum, right? So you don't want one room in the house to get to 90 degrees. And so it'll have a set number, but it'll allow the temperature in that room to go up to 76, 77, 78, wherever you want to set it, as long as there's nobody in there. But as soon as somebody walks in the room, that air handler engages automatically and cools the room down very, very quickly.
And I can imagine that the programming could get very involved according to a customer's preferences.
Oh, incredibly involved. And that's where we're seeing a lot of changes in our industry, is that everything these days is computer controlled. Everything's computer circuit board driven. Tons and tons of sensors throughout the house, both humidity sensors as well as temperature sensors. And so that's really the struggle in our industry, is to gain people, workers, technicians that are trained to not only do the heavy lifting and the grunt work that you would think of in our industry, but also be very adept with computers and laptops and tablets, and be able to program these systems so that they can operate and function properly. That's really the struggle that we're having in our industry these days.
With those two ranges, do you have people that specialize only in the programming side of things, where they're not actually involved in the installation, they're just involved in facilitating the customer's preferences and the optimal programming of the heating and cooling?
Yeah, we've actually, so there's a major differential these days in our industry between a quote unquote installer and then a technician. And so what'll happen is that we'll have the installers go out and physically install the equipment, but not really turn the unit on. And then we'll have a technician come back afterwards, program the system, get the unit started, and service the refrigerant and do all those technical things that need to happen to make sure that system's operating properly.
Okay. That is interesting. And it does show the point. That is something that probably requires a much higher level of proficiency and understanding of how it all works.
Absolutely. And
when I say that, I mean, casually, I mean, obviously, you know, well, you know, the guy's got to know more, but it seems to me like a tacit, intuitive, deep understanding.
Absolutely. Yeah, very much so. And I relate it in many ways to the vehicle, to the automotive industry, right? Back in the day when I was growing up as a kid, there were a lot of shade tree mechanics that could, you know, repair your automobile or change out an engine and do all those things. And in today's world, that's not the case. You have to go to somebody that's got, you know, $15,000-$20,000 worth of test equipment just to figure out what sensor is wrong on your vehicle. Mm-hmm. And that's really what's happening in HVAC as well, is that it takes a lot of test equipment, a lot of specialized tooling, and a lot of specialized knowledge to understand what's going on with the system to be able to troubleshoot it and repair it.
Very, very interesting. I'm definitely learning, I'll say that. So this is what you do day in and day out. How did you get here? How did you get started in the blue-collar world?
Well, I happen to grow up in a family that had two family businesses. My father's side of the family did general contracting work. We did everything from renovations to building homes from the ground up. My mother's side of the family had a small HVAC company that my grandfather started from nothing. And so, you know, family business, what that means is that when you're big enough to start carrying stuff, that you start working during the summer. And that's really kind of how I got started. Just got woke up one morning, first day of summer, and said, hey, get up and get in the truck. And from then it was just go to work.
And you had no premonition this was coming?
No, nobody warned me. It was just, get in the truck, let's go. And so, there was no warning. That was a pretty rough summer, that first summer. By the way, my young boy happens to be 10 this year. And so guess what he got to do this summer? And it was his first summer working as well. I didn't work him the entire summer. I only worked him the first month, but he got a real, real good taste. He had a good time the first month working with Dad this year.
I can imagine. And did you tell him that this happened to you, that you're just passing this on?
Oh, yes. Yeah. He got the full story. Not that he was happy about it, but he got the full story.
All right, Dad, what do I got to do?
That's it.
Oh, that's cool. So when you first started out, you just hauling things, moving boards around, doing this, and you had a lot of peers. You said this is a family business. And so you had a lot of peers, yes, teaching you, telling you what to do, telling you why things were being done. How much of an impact did that make on you when you're 10 years old, you're going out, you're seeing all of this, as far as your worldview and seeing how things come together? What were you thinking back then?
You know, when I was 10, I was just thinking, good God, it's hot outside. Growing up doing it year over year over year, you know, I spent the bulk of my time around adults every day. I didn't spend a whole lot of time with the kids. And so it really made me understand a lot about how the world worked. I think that's missing in today's world. I think kids are very isolated from how the world actually operates. It's funny to me that, you know, you go through 12 years worth of schooling by the time you graduate high school, and probably the one thing that they don't teach is money or how to make it or what to do with it after you got it. And by the way, don't spend it on dumb stuff. And but the day that you graduate from high school, all of that becomes the most important thing in your entire world. And so it's funny that that we don't teach that. So growing up, that's where I learned it. I learned it actually out in the world and working, and how to make money and how to manage people and how to manage job sites and long job sites and job routines, right? Like building a house from the ground up is a 3-month undertaking, 5-month undertaking, depending on what you're doing. And so how to manage those things. I think my childhood was a lot different than, a lot different than my neighbor's childhood, to be honest with you.
Well, on that note, when you've done all of that, you're in high school, you're interacting with the other guys, the other, you know, your friends, your peers, there had to have been some differences, but what kind of differences did you see, and how did they relate to you and you relate to them based on your worldview?
I just didn't hang out with a lot of those people. Like, I had one or two friends growing up as a kid and growing up in high school, but I just didn't relate very well to childhood notions. And I understood what it took and how much work it took to make something happen or to go get the things that you needed to get. Right. And so I think a good analogy is that, you look at the back of a candy bar and you see how many calories they are, and you go, man, okay, well, that's only 500 calories or 400 calories or what it is. Well, that sounds good until you have to get on a freaking treadmill, right? And then you're usually really surprised at how far and how hard you have to run to burn off 400 stupid calories. That kind of makes you appreciate.
Absolutely.
Kind of makes you appreciate that candy bar a little bit. Well, to me, working was the same thing. I understood what it took, to get $100 in your pocket. And then consequently, because I understood the amount of effort, I understood not to spend $100 on a bunch of stupid stuff. Let's do something constructive with it. So
did you ever, based on your experience, did you ever hear anything from the teachers where you're like, obviously you don't get it, teacher, because they perhaps didn't have the right or a cognizant realistic worldview as well?
There's that whole analogy. I'll probably make a few of my friends mad because they happen to be teachers, but there's that whole verse that says something about those who can't do,
I know where
those
you're
who
going.
Can't teach, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
It's the funny thing to me is that I think in today's world, a lot of what we hear and see is theoretical. What we teach our children, they're teaching them in theory, because they don't, they've never had the opportunity to actually do it. They only know what's in the books. And it's funny how, what the books tell you to do versus what actually needs to happen sometimes is two different things. But no, I don't think that I had a whole lot of conversations with teachers or confrontations with teachers about, what was right or wasn't right. But I didn't agree with a lot of it for sure. I thought that a lot of what we were studying was nonsense and things that weren't going to affect me after I got out of high school. And so I just didn't pay a lot of attention to it, to be honest with you.
I know where you're going on that. And, I graduated barely, and I was bored out of my freaking mind, and I hated school, and I didn't understand what the value of anything that they were trying to get me to learn was. And there certainly are things that I should have grasped and spent more time learning, but most of it just felt like it was just a waste of time. And one of the most valuable things that I actually got out of school was just learning how to type. I mean, because back then, it wasn't as important as it is today, but being able to type is pretty essential.
Yeah, that was a class I should have paid way more attention in had I known what was coming.
Well, back then, that was just something that secretaries did, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, what? Well, not to mention, there was a young girl named Melissa that sat in front of me that I was way more interested in. Yes, I mean, nobody typed. What was I going to need typing for? But I had no idea where computers was going, nor did anybody. So, right. Yeah, I should have paid way more attention.
It is such. Well, first off, I did learn the typing, but I wanted to, my last my last 2 years of high school, there was a teacher. He was a physics teacher, math teacher, but he, during the summer, he built houses. And it wasn't that I wanted to build houses or anything, but he was always using real life examples and showing how math applied. And here's how you did this. And here's why. And it brought it alive because it wasn't just abstract. It was like, here is why things work. And it was more than just house building. He used innumerable examples whenever we would have, and he would always have these open forums and we would ask him questions about all kinds of stuff. I mean, I was like, you know, why does ice freeze? I mean, it doesn't matter, but he would always make it real and why it was important to know these things and how they applied, which was just looking back over my educational journey. Nobody does that. We want you to learn this. Why? Because I freaking said so. Now, they don't use those words, but that's why it was. You just had to do it. You had to do it to get to the next grade. This is your assigned task. Why? Nobody brings it alive.
Yeah. And in today's world, the only reason you're learning it is because they want you to pass the START test, right? Like you have to pass the test at the end of each year to be able to move on to the next thing. And so really all they're doing is they're teaching you whatever is going to be on that test so that you can absolutely move on to the next. It's not relational. I have a hard time relating to our school system these days.
And even then, when they start dabbling in things that are potentially valuable, they're way behind. It's like you can do better. You can get on YouTube and get more up-to-date experiences.
Well, and there's the touch that really needs to be handled, right? Is that our school system from the time that it was started was designed for you to memorize and be able to retain and to retrieve information in your head. Really, that's all it is. It's how much information can I teach you that you can retain, that you can remember and be able to regurgitate it when needed. And in today's world, that's not needed. Pretty much everything that you ever wanted to know is at the touch of your fingers. When I was in math class and we asked, you know, can we use our calculator? The answer was, well, you're not always going to have a calculator in your pocket, Chris. Well, guess what I got in my pocket now all day long, every day, right? And I'm pretty sure there's a calculator app on it.
It's called a phone. And I don't know. We call it a phone, but that's a small part of what it does.
Well, it's a better computer than Ronald Reagan had to rule the entire world.
Exactly.
Which is hilarious. I really think that it's not so much the memorization of the information these days that I think needs to be taught. I think you need to teach young people today, A, where to find the information that's needed, and then B, how to utilize it. Right. So it shouldn't be memorizing facts and figures. It should be what information do I need? Where do I go get it? And then how do I utilize it to solve whatever the problem is? And so I think
absolutely rational problem solving.
There you go. So I think we need a big change in our education system these days. But that's really not my specialty, I guess.
Well, you know, the people that you see online that are, say, in high school, that have excelled, that have just done this unique stuff, this is not something that the school guided them in. It always seems that it's an independent course of study of something that they've just initiated, and they're 17 years old, and they came out with this thing and they work within a peer group. I mean, these people are getting together. I say these people. I mean, it's just the 17-year-olds maybe hanging out with 30-year-olds and 11-year-olds and 14-year-olds or whatever. This is a group of people that think like they do, and they kind of come together online. And this 17-year-old may have their own project, but they tap into a particular viewpoint and aspect and way of learning and approaching things that help raise each other up.
Yeah, I totally agree.
And we have people today that are great mindless drones. They show up and do their work and they complain. They provide the bare minimum necessary, but they get work done. You get enough of them together and they make things happen. It's a cost to the business, but without them, how would they get it done? And one of the other things is, as we have our society skews more towards we're headed more towards requiring people that can think creatively and logically and solve problems rather than just people that just show up and mindlessly just like, I'm going to call it, say, digging a ditch all day long, which it's always been more than that. But but you have the guy that is, there's some jobs that require more problem solving skills than others. There's some jobs that just require a tenacity and ability to work hard and long and get the job done. The job that requires more creativity, more problem solving, it's going to be the one that pays more money because it's harder to do. And as we shift towards more and more of that, there's people that aren't capable of that. And what are they going to do?
Right. Well, our school system was never designed to make you into a entrepreneur or to make you into a leader or a business person. It was designed to make you into an employee and a job, and that was it. In fact, right, that's all we've ever taught our kids is that go to school, get good grades, and then get out and go get a job. And nobody ever taught their children, hey, maybe you should think about starting a business. Maybe you should learn about investing instead of saving. And so the world's changed. And I just don't know that the school system has changed with it. And in fact, I'll tell you it hasn't. But and I'm with you. And you're right. The only time that we see successful people these days is when there's five or six of them that all get together who think differently and mash their heads together. And that's when they come up with something that's world changing.
True. To kind of summarize on the educational side of things, what do you think that we should do to help solve this problem? I mean, from not just theoretically, but
man, I wish I had the answer, right? The actual actionable items that we should do, man, I don't know. I wish I knew. I wish I had some grand plan. I'd end up probably being, a billionaire. But no, I don't have a. I don't know. I wish I did. It's not my specialization, and I'm sure that somebody somewhere is going to come up with the base, with the best plan. But I just hope they do it soon.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and change topics a little bit. So you worked at your family business. You're continuing to work and grow. You graduated
high school and joined the Air Force.
Okay. So tell me about your Air Force experience.
So I joined the Air Force mainly to get the GI Bill. I was pretty tired after, crawling around under people's houses and in their attics for, all of my childhood. I was pretty tired of that for a while and wanted to go to school and get some real education. So I joined the Air Force mainly to do that so that I could, get a college education. The plan was to do 4 years, get out and go to school, and that turned into 20. Finally retired in 2009 as a master sergeant. I have participated or ran organizations as small as 5 people to as large as 500. I did get my degree in business while I was in, and was very happy to have that completed. It only took me 13 years to get a 4-year degree, but that's because I was doing it part time while you're deployed. Pretty mm-hmm. interesting to be sitting in Iraq or Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia getting shot at and people throwing Scud missiles at you while you're taking, while you're taking a class and trying to do your homework. It it takes a little bit longer when those things are happening around you. But I grew up in the military doing aircraft maintenance. I worked on fighter airplanes, and I did that until I made enough stripes that they don't let you work anymore, and they put you in an office and make you start managing people. And that's kind of where I learned how to manage people and how to run projects. The military puts you through a lot of managerial training and leadership schools and things of that nature, which are highly, highly valuable to me and has really done great things for me even after the military.
Right. That's awesome. You worked on the aircraft, and would you be considered a quote mechanic, or what, how deep did that go as far as that concept?
Yes, sir. So an aircraft mechanic, I was what was called a crew chief. So a crew chief is in charge of the entire aircraft, from the hydraulic systems to the flight controls to the jet engines to all of it. And then you have specialized technicians that would come out and work on certain areas of the aircraft as you were overseeing it. So like the guys that worked on the ejection seat or on the canopy or certain areas of the aircraft. So I was not the specialized guy. I was a guy that, that kind of oversaw the entire airplane. It was a great time of my life. Absolutely loved working on airplanes.
Okay. That's awesome. And just kind of looking at your LinkedIn profile, you got out of the military and at some particular point in time, you kind of took back over the family business and you turned it around.
Absolutely. Yes, sir. We moved back to Texas. Yes, sir. Retired out of Hill Air Force Base in Utah. Came back to Texas and took over the family's HVAC business, which was not doing well. My uncle had downsized it dramatically to the point that it was too small and not really viable. And so I took it over and ran it for about 4 years. We were highly successful for little small town Killeen, Texas, but my family's not okay with that. They don't want it to be a big company. They want to keep it a little small mom and pop shop, and that's just not who I am. And so so I gave them the company back at the end and ended up moving to Houston.
Okay, so two things there, maybe more. But the first thing is, what is it that you did that was what is it that you brought that really turned the business around and helped it grow?
Well, so I was kind of I was computer knowledgeable at that point, right? And so first of all, you're talking about small town Killeen, Texas, and you're talking about 2009, 2010. And if you kind of look backwards and think about when did Google come up? Well, that was about that time frame, right? 2009, 2010 is when Google started to get really big. And that's when right. Google AdWords became really big. Mm-hmm. And so so we were, you know, we set up our website real early in the game and started using Google AdWords to put our name out ahead of everybody else. And that was a big part of us being successful there.
That's awesome. Okay, good. I like it, being innovative and taking advantage of what you can.
Absolutely. Up until then, the only thing anybody had ever done in the air conditioning industry is put your ad in the yellow pages, and maybe in the classified ads of the newspaper. And I'm not kidding. 2009, 2010, that's still the only thing anybody did in Killeen, Texas to advertise their business.
Killeen is a military city.
It is. Yeah. It is the largest army facility, in the world. We had no military affiliation. Nobody in my family had ever been in the army. Just happens to be where we were from. That was all.
Okay. Did the base rely on civilian contractors to help keep their AC equipment running, or was that all in-house?
The base did, for sure. We didn't do any of that. We were primarily residential. We did some light commercial work in town, but the bulk of what we did was residential work.
Okay. So you decided you want to do your own thing. You said, I'll move to Houston where it's hot. Everybody needs AC and there's a lot of competition.
Yeah. You know, I say I was going to do my own thing. I didn't really jump right out and make that leap yet. I went to work for a 20-year-old plumbing company that had just been bought out by an investment group. And part of that whole deal was that you have to start an AC division. So I was the guy who started the AC division, and I ran that AC division in that company for 2 years. We went from zero to $15 million a year in revenue in a 2-year time period. That was a crazy 2 years. To build a division within a company to that level in 2 years was really, really tough. But it was really exciting to see it all happen, and to be the guy that was pulling the strings for it. And really, to me, that was my first glimpse at, hey, we may be onto something here. And right.
I can imagine there would be just a phenomenal number of lessons that you learned kind of starting that from scratch and growing it that you applied later when you started your own company.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Everything from marketing to, you know, hiring people and how to scale the business without losing your mind, how to divide up the people into groups of teams of people so that you can continue to be successful even at a high volume. Yeah, there was tons and tons of lessons that were learned there. You know, and I've said this before, in the HVAC career field, every technician will tell you, I want to own my own business. And they usually work for somebody for 5-6 years, and then they want to break out and start their own company from scratch. And I always suggest against that. I tell them, listen, if you want to do that, what you really need to do is you need to go and run somebody else's company for them as a general manager for a couple of years and make all the mistakes on somebody else's dime. Right.
Right. Right.
Let them pay for you to screw it up a couple of times so that you're not learning those lessons the hard way out of your own pocket. And then after you've learned all the lessons, then go start your own business, but don't do it on your own right off the bat.
But if you're doing it for another company, I think you also benefit from a little bit of mentorship. I mean, you are collaborating. There's a little bit of push and pull. You can experiment, but you have some oversight.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was great. I mean, like I said, it was a 20-year-old plumbing company. So, I mean, obviously they knew what they were doing as far as business management were concerned and how to have a call center and do those things. And, you know, so yeah, there were a lot of lessons to learn there just to see how they had constructed the existing business. Yeah, absolutely. Anytime that you can get involved in the business side and see somebody that's been successful for 20 years, there's a ton of lessons to learn there for sure.
Do you do any plumbing now or is it strictly AC?
No, right now it's strictly air conditioning.
Okay. So when you ended up your time, when you took over, well, not when you took over, when you created this division and you built the HVAC up for the plumbing company, when it finally ended up, how many crews did you have? How many people? Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. So we did $15 million in revenue that year. We were running, I want to say we had 16 or 17 technicians at that point. And we were running 6, I believe, installation crews. And so somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 people just within that division. Yeah, it was a lot. We bought a lot of trucks. We had to create a whole new warehouse division. We had a warehouse manager. We had a manager that was only overseeing the installation crews. Then we had another. We took the technicians and broke them up into teams. And so we would have teams of 5 technicians, with one of those technicians being the lead tech of that team. And so they would, if there were any questions, they would be funneled into the lead tech first as their first round. And if he couldn't solve the problem or figure out what to do, then it would come back to the manager, you know, for their recommendations. But so yeah, trying to figure out how to scale a business to that size was pretty interesting to watch as well.
When you had the group of 5 techs, one's the leader, each one of those techs, did they have like their own truck and generally go out and do their own service calls or did they work together?
Absolutely. Yeah. Every tech had his own vehicle. Every tech was autonomous on his own. But you'd be surprised throughout the course of a day when you're running 4, 5, 6 calls, how many questions come up, right? Like, hey, how do I do this? Or what's this? Or I can't find the pricing for that, or whatever the questions were. And if you only had one manager trying to run, you know, 15, 16, 17 people, you wouldn't get anything else done. And so it was probably one of the more intelligent things that we did was to break them up into teams. And so they would all communicate with each other. And then if the question still couldn't be answered, or if we couldn't figure out what to do, then it would go up to the managerial level.
Kind of filter up, bubble up.
Yeah. Yeah. You gave some leadership. So first of all, one of the things that you don't find in this industry is that technicians feel like they don't have anywhere to grow. They're just a technician and they're always going to be a technician. And so what do I do? Like, where's my growth opportunity? And so what we created by doing that is there was a growth opportunity to now become a lead technician to oversee a team of 5 people. that kind of got them involved in the whole, okay, now I'm learning how to manage people. You know, I mean, I'm still at tech and I'm still out running service calls and doing those things, but now I'm also kind of halfway managing, you know, four other technicians. And not only did we just have the questions filtered through that guy, but we made him kind of responsible for gathering a lot of the financial data and the performance data for his techs. And he would present that data to the manager at the end of each month and that type of thing. And so that was the beginning stages of them learning how to manage personnel. And then later down the road, the growth opportunity was, well, now you can run into one of the lower level managerial positions, oversee the installation crews or become a quality control check guy or those types of things, create those growth opportunities for those technicians so they feel like they're continuing to progress.
Excellent. Have you,
in fact, we designed all of this that completely. Oh, yeah, yeah. We designed all of this completely off of the way that we ran things in the military. So the military is the same way. You start off as a three level right out of tech school, and you get to do all the grunt work, but you don't actually get to do anything without having somebody watching over your shoulder. Well, after you've done that enough, then you become a five level, and now you're training the three levels on how to do it, but you're still doing a lot of the work yourself. And then after you've been in for a long enough time, then you become a seven level. Well, now you don't really do a whole lot. You oversee a ton, but you oversee the five levels and only get involved with the three levels when you have to. And so it's that progression of leadership is what we tried to design that model after with the technicians, to where you're a tech, then you're a lead tech, and then you get to become a quality control guy, and then maybe run into a lower level managerial position, and then maybe eventually get to become the general manager of a division. And so we want to make sure that they understand that there is growth potential, because the churn of people leaving to go to other companies these days is just dramatic. And it's only for, I'll be honest, when people come and interview with me and I ask them why they're leaving their current position, it's never because I can make more money here. It's always because, well, I just felt like I was stuck, or I didn't like my manager. It's always people and growth. And so that's what we tried to create a model of, to where we could keep our people and not ever lose them to another company.
Quick interruption. At this point in the conversation, something went wrong and Chris was no longer able to hear me. We continued where we left off the next day. My audio was terrible going forwards, but it is what it is. We recap briefly and get back into it. Now, back to the show.
So I guess let's just go ahead and pick up where we left off about the guys who are interviewing at your company and why they're leaving.
Right. So, I mean, like I said, anytime I interview somebody that's coming in to interview for a position, I always ask them, why are you thinking about, or why are you leaving your existing company? And I'm never told that it's about the money. It's always about the people, the management. I feel like I'm stuck. Like I've been a tech there for 2 years or 3 years or 5 years, and there's no place for me to grow. And so what we've done is that we've taken the Air Force's model of how to give that projection of where I'm supposed to be moving forward, right? You know, I'm a brand new one stripe airman today, and then I'm going to make my second stripe, and then I'm going to move up to sergeant, and then what are those responsibilities? And so if you don't give somebody in your business a growth opportunity, something to shoot for moving forward, you're eventually going to lose that person because they feel like there may be some opportunity that they're missing out on elsewhere. And for that reason, we adopted the Air Force's model of growth and opportunity moving forward. And it's worked amazing for us.
Yeah, I could see that. And I think that if you didn't adopt that model, they would know that there wasn't any room for growth. And so they would leave, because people don't want, okay, the typical person doesn't want to just stay. They want to advance. They want to make more money. They want a career path. And so it sounds like you're really making that happen.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's something that's missing in this industry for sure. I mean, name me another company where, you know, you're hired on as a technician. Well, what's the next step? You know, and I can tell you now, the larger companies that are more corporate atmosphere, they are not creating growth opportunities for people that are their technicians or even their installation guys in the, out in the field. When it comes to, hey, we're getting ready to hire a low-level management position, they're looking for people outside of the career field. They're hiring people out of oil and gas. They're hiring people out of other construction areas, but they're not hiring anybody within our actual own career field, which I think is tragic, because now I've got a manager, low-level manager, or mid-level manager with no idea as to what actually happens out in the field every day.
Right. Are you yourself, as you're growing your company working, are you still looking for people? Is this something that you have a battle to try to find good employees?
Yes. And we look for them even when we don't need them because they're right. So hard to find that if you do run up on them, you can't not hire them. Like, you just can't. And we're in that position. I think I've said this a little bit. We don't hire salespeople. My technicians are our salespeople. I, which is not the industry standard these days. Everybody wants to have a technician go out, diagnose that the system needs to be replaced or that there's a major repair. And then they tell the homeowner, hey, hang on a minute, I'm going to have my quote unquote supervisor come out. Well, that supervisor is not really a supervisor. That supervisor is a trained salesperson who really doesn't have any technical experience whatsoever in HVAC. They're just there to make a sale, to close a sale. I don't believe in that. And we don't do it. And so I'm looking for real good technicians that understand HVAC, that are willing and capable to make repairs when that's really what should be done in that situation, as opposed to replacing systems and replacing equipment that could be repaired when it's financially sound to do so. And So, to me, it's better to take somebody that understands the technical aspects of what we do and teach them to make sales, as opposed to taking a sales guy and trying to teach him the technical aspects of what we do.
That also means that the customer, any question they ask, they have a good answer. I mean, the tech knows, he knows both sides of it. He can see the math. He can see this is the cost, but
right,
he can also let that customer know this is exactly why we're doing this. This is exactly why we're doing this and why we can and why we can't. It's almost like a one-stop service.
Yes. And listen, a sales guy is there to make a sale. Like, let's be honest, right? They're going to get paid commission. And so for them, it's the most expensive sale that I can make, because that's more money in my pocket on the, you know, at the end of the week. And so my technicians, however, on the other hand, they're not paid that way. They're paid hourly rates, and that's it. You know, they're there to do real work. So they're there at the behest of the client. They're there to do the right thing for the homeowner. So that's why they're there. And they're to me, I get it. It's a slower way to build my business. It's a slower way to build the company. But from an ethical and moral standpoint, I think it's the best way to do it. I can sleep at night. And my clients are going to be lifelong clients, not see me this year or next year, and then I never see them again. In fact, you'll notice I always use the word client. We don't refer to anybody here as a customer. In my mind, a customer is what you get at a gas station. Somebody walks in and buys a candy bar, or they get a tank full of gas, and you never see them again, and that's okay. That's a customer. To me, we want clients.
You're taking long-term relationship.
Yes, long-term. I want people that are going to see us every year, twice a year, for the next 15 to 20 years.
I like that. So that kind of brings me to one of the other questions I have here is, where do you plan on taking your business? What is your, like, your future projections?
Well, I mean, we started off small. Spring Branch Air Conditioning has always just been a small mom and pop shop before I became involved with the company. We plan on doing business that way, in the same manner that I just described, as in we're doing the right thing for our clients and growing client base. But we're okay with slow growth. And this is a long-term game for me. I mean, we want this to continue to be our company. It's not something that I want to grow to a particular level and then sell off like most like most companies are trying to do these days. I have two boys. One is 24 and one is 10. And I'm hoping that probably in the next 10 to 12, one of them, if not both of them, will be ready to jump into the industry and take it over. So, we're going to grow, we're going to do it properly. And it's a long-term game for us.
It's kind of like a legacy.
Well, that's the idea, right? You don't see that much in today's world. Everybody wants to buy a business, grow it quickly, flip it to an investment group, and then get into the next. And that's not the plan here.
Okay. Well, you know, I'll be honest. I really wasn't aware of that aspect, and that's something that you're bringing to my attention. I just didn't know. And so that's an interesting factoid to know that a lot of people aren't looking for long-term. They're just trying to flip something.
So I do a lot of consulting as well. And, what you'll find is that, the only consulting jobs that I get are from investment groups, financial investment groups that are looking to buy, service-based businesses. And really what they're wanting are the ones that are in the $8 to $10 million a year range. And they're hoping that it's multifaceted, as in HVAC slash plumbing slash electrical. And they understand that it is a high volume, possibly high net profit at the end of the year type business. And those businesses are being bought up very, very quickly these days by financial investment groups and becoming very, very corporate based.
Do you think, based on your experience, that once they become more corporate based, more of an investor owned company, does that negatively or positively impact the profitability?
In most cases, it's a positive effect. And let's clarify that, right? So how does somebody in the HVAC industry, how did they get there? Well, most guys, they were in high school and it's their sophomore year. And dad said, hey, it's summertime. You got to go get a job. And there was no place for them to go and they didn't want to deliver pizza. So their buddy's friend's uncle's cousin was in the air conditioning business. And so he got a job delivering parts or working in the warehouse or as an install helper or something. And then he did that for the next couple of years in high school. And then he got out of high school and said, well, you know, I'm not going to go to college because I don't have money for that. But I got to go get money and I know how to do this air conditioning thing. And so I'll just do that for the next couple of years. And then next thing you know, it's 10 years later and they're still in the business. And somehow or another, they got busy enough that they got a couple of trucks and a couple of buddies together and they started a company. And so while they may be the best technicians and know exactly what they're doing when it comes from a technical aspect, they have no training when it comes to running a business. And that's usually where small mom and pop shop companies go awry. And that's why we see so many of them come and go and fail, is because there's no training in financials. There's no training in business management. There's no, right. You know, they know what they're doing from an air conditioning standpoint, but from that business standpoint, they don't. So what we see is there's a few of them that succeed and they get to that $5, $6, $7, $8 million mark. Usually that's the hard, that's a really hard jump. Usually what we see is they'll get to that $3 to $5 million a year mark. And then they can never figure out how to make that next level step. And then somebody comes in, swoops in and tries to buy them. And they get bought out fairly quickly. Or they do make that jump to the $8 million, $10 million mark because they brought on plumbing or they brought on electrical, a second, you know, service. And then they they really get bought out very quickly when that happens. But because of the lack of training, of business training, when it does become corporate based, they do put in a lot of people that understand the financial side and the profitability side. And it becomes very profitable to the company. What you find is that the prices to the consumer gets incredibly high as well. But yeah, so there's a lot of give and takes there.
I see. Well, thank you for that.
Sure.
What kind of special challenges do you see for the HVAC industry going forward?
Well, we spoke about it a little bit. First, the units themselves, the systems themselves are becoming very, very complicated, very, very computer driven, lots of sensors all over the house and
right.
Specialized test equipment to be able to diagnose. And so that's becoming really hard to be able to get the right talented people in the door that you can provide that training to, and they can absorb it and be able to utilize it properly. That's really hard. And that's the second part is people. It's no secret that service-based companies, plumbing, electrical, HVAC, all of those, and then some, it's really hard to find people these days that want to do this for a living, that want to get dirty and sweat in people's attics all day and do that stuff. And so it's getting harder and harder to find people at all, let alone qualified people that I can provide that type of high-end training to be able to work on these units. So, yeah, people and skills. That's our big challenge moving forward. And I don't think it's going to shift towards the positive for another 8 to 10 years. We do see that there's a lot of new technical schools popping up, both private based as well as in some of the community colleges and those types of things. And that's helpful. But it's not anywhere near enough yet to provide us the manpower and the technical expertise that we need at this time.
Gotcha. So you're based out of Houston?
Yes, sir.
And what do you cover, just Houston, or do you have a further reach right now than just Houston?
No, not at all. Houston's a big place to begin with. there's a lot of, it is a huge place, and there's a giant demand for what we provide in services. We try to provide to the Northwest Corridor. Our office is at 290 and Beltway 8 on the west side, northwest side, and we try to go from I-10 and then kind of that northern swath all the way up to 45. And so kind of the Northwest Corridor of Houston is our main service hub. So we go from downtown Houston all the way as far north as Conroe, and all the way as far west as Katy.
Okay. And I don't have a map pulled up, and I'm not that familiar with it, but it definitely sounds like it's just a subset of Houston.
It is. It's a huge area. If I had to map it out, we're probably 45 square miles, which is a lot of area to cover.
Right. So how can people reach you? What's the best way that you like to be contacted?
It wasn't that long ago that my phone just rang off the hook all day, every day, right? And then in today's world, they don't really call us very much. To be honest, I get more text message requests for services than I do telephone these days. So you can always find us on Facebook. We're super huge on Facebook. That's probably our most popular platform at this point. So it's at Spring Branch AC. Super easy to find us there. Just hit us up on Facebook Messenger. You can always find the website at Spring Branch AC or springbranchair.com. We are on Instagram as well. Feel free to DM us on Instagram. By the way, anytime you send a message on Facebook or Instagram, there's even a text messaging capability on our website when you pop it up. Anytime you're texting that, you're getting me directly. You're not getting somebody else. It's not a third-party organization. It's me. Or you can call the direct line or even text the direct phone number into the office, which is 713-213-2683. And once again, I'm the guy you get every single day, all day. It's nobody else.
That's awesome, Chris.
Well, yeah, it's a headache, but it's awesome.
Yeah, hey, that's, you know what? If what we do is solve problems, and if there weren't problems, nobody would pay us.
There you go. We'd be out of a job quickly if there was no more problems to be fixed.
Exactly. So one final thing, I'm planning a road trip across America and actually going to be a little bit in Canada. And would you be open to being a destination on my trip?
I would love to have you down here in Houston. We'd be happy to host you. Just give me a ring and let me know.
All right. Sounds great. Chris, I really appreciate you taking the time out and talking with us about your business and sharing everything. And I hope that all my listeners enjoy it. And I will talk to you later, sir.
Outstanding. Thanks, John.
On the next episode of Blue Collar Voices, we have Jason Maldonado. He is a safety expert and consultant that just wrote a book about safety. Jason has a great sense of humor and incorporated that into the book as well. I had a fun time talking with Jason, and I learned a lot too. Here's a very short snippet from the next episode.
You go out in your area and you need to find the one wire situations. You know, where are we one step away from catastrophe? And it doesn't matter why we're there. It doesn't matter if it was because somebody didn't do their job or somebody was terrible at their job. That none of that matters. What matters is finding that thing and what you do with it. You know, I don't think that we're terribly good at that. I think we're good at waiting for something to happen and then figuring out all the things that people did wrong.
Hey guys, before you go, two things. The first is I'm looking for more great guests for the Blue Collar Voices show. Basically, I'm looking for those that excel in the blue collar arena and have actually got their hands dirty, truly understanding what it is like to do the work. I realize this is an older podcast, but I'm updating this podcast in November 2019 for the announcement of an upcoming road trip. Phase one is building a list of locations to visit. Some locations will be just a meet and greet. Others will be on-site audio and